Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. PBS, the public broadcasting service, has a long-standing and lofty reputation for the caliber of its programming and commitment to news and public affairs, the arts and education, not to mention quality entertainment programming. With 350 member stations, PBS is the nation's largest non-commercial media organization. But in today's evolving media landscape, as people look to other sources for information and entertainment, what does the future hold for mainstream media in general and for PBS in particular? We're happy to have in our studio Paula Kerger, the president and CEO of PBS. She's in town to help the Nine Network, Channel 9, observe its 60th anniversary and to celebrate this weekend's opening of the Public Media Commons shared with St. Louis Public Radio. Paula Kerger, welcome. It's so nice to see you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
I'd like to start with a couple of questions that I think are on the minds of a lot of people with regard to this changing media landscape we're all experiencing. How is that impacting PBS, and how do you think it's likely to?
I think this is one of the most fascinating times to be in media, actually, because when you look at the work that continues on television, and television viewership is really continues to be at record highs. But then you have all these various platforms where one can distribute and showcase talent and content. And there's also the opportunity through some of these platforms to begin to develop content in different forms and formats. And so as someone who's now been in this business for a long time and has worked on programs that you bring to air and in the what now I think of as the golden olden days, you would put up on the air, it would sort of go out there and you'd hope that an audience would find it. But now with the opportunity to stream content online, to have content available on tablets and smartphones, to use services like Roku or Netflix and so forth, you can really create a library. And for an organization like Public Media that creates content that has impact and I would say lasting value, to be able to have that kind of archive available to the public is tremendously exciting.
Is it likely, do you think, to impact your funding? I mean, you rely so much on public funding and people are going
many places. Yeah. And actually, that's an excellent question, because one of the challenges for us is really making sure that we are connecting to people not only as viewers, but hopefully continuing to build that relationship so that they support their local stations, so that whether you're watching something on television or you're connecting through some of these other platforms and devices, your local media organization, your local station is right at the center of that relationship. And so really thinking about what that means looking forward, I think, is one of the big both challenges, but I also think opportunities for us.
You know, someone who is close to me media in this city said to me the other day, actually in advance, knowing that you're going to be on the program, that it was their feeling that this whole environment could be the death knell for public broadcasting.
Well, some say that, but I'll tell you, you know, we're now the sixth most watched network, and we've risen three places in the last year. So we're sixth in terms of size of audience after the networks in ESPN. And to be honest, we're nipping at ESPN's heels. I think that, you know, as you look at the content that we produce, which is very focused on material that is, you know, of great authenticity and quality, it has served us well. And so I think that one would assume that public broadcasting is just suffering in this media landscape. But actually, the opposite is happening. Our audiences are large. We have a little show on the air you might have heard of called Downton Abbey. It has the largest audience of any drama show in public broadcasting history. Think about that. You know, at a time when there were three networks in PBS, obviously we had a very large audience, and this is bringing in more people now than then. So,
you know, that's almost an anomaly, because commercial television, if I may say so, and it's my opinion, really shows an awful lot of junk, and there's a large audience for that. I mean, and yet here we have this quality broadcasting that we're talking about that is drawing huge audiences. That has to say something about what people really want.
I think it says a lot about the American public, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and it is interesting. When you look at what is on television right now, I actually think that right now we are in a sort of a golden age of drama on television, and you know, particularly on some of the cable channels, and now actually on places like Netflix, you have really wonderful, well-written series that have been produced. And then you have a lot of reality shows. And so it's there's this huge swing between programs that I think are really some of the best that has appeared on television. And then you have these other programs. Some of them are interesting, but they're very much entertainment. Mm-hmm. And for us, there's this big opportunity in the middle for programs of really great quality. We have Ken Burns coming up on beginning on Sunday with his 14-hour documentary series on the Roosevelts. And that, you know, he has worked in public broadcasting his entire career, and for a reason, because we give him a place where he can bring his work, and it will be well showcased, and the public comes.
You're devoting 28 hours to that, 14 hours in the first run, and then later that evening, you're going to repeat it, as I understand. That's a heck of a commitment for a program like that.
And we're also making it available streaming. So if you go on the Nine Network site, you'll be able to stream it as well, beginning with the first broadcast. So we're experimenting. This is the first time we've done that. We've streamed his work after it's broadcast. But this is such a big and important series. And as we're talking about, you know, the world has changed, we're really experimenting to see how people will connect with it.
You know, he was on the Diane Rehm show earlier today, and he's also very, very good at promoting his own material.
Yes.
As well it should be promoted, because it is consistently excellent. But he was almost giddy talking about the way this is being presented this time. He talked about when he started in the days of analog video presentation and what have you. He called it the democratization of television today, because you're streaming it, you're putting it on for 4 hours a night, you're going to be streaming it the next day. He said the digital version, DVR is going to be, or the, what I'm trying to think of it, the disc.
The DVDs.
Yeah, the DVDs is what I'm trying to think of, are going to be out. And he says this, and gives people the opportunity to watch what they want, when they want, how long they want to do it, whether it's binge viewing or what have you. Democratization of television.
He's right. You know, and it is interesting, because when you look at how people are consuming media, coming back to your very first question, you have what is an accelerating trend of people that really want to manage their own schedule. So, yes, there are a lot of people that come home at night and wonder what's on TV, and flick it on and go through the channels and find what they want to watch. There are a lot of people that are mindful about trying to pick what they want. There are a lot of people that go on to demand services and sort of look at the schedule and then try to figure out. And so for us, we are trying to put content wherever people might happen to want to have that experience. And I think that So we're watching that, and we're really mindful of making sure that our content is in all these various places so that people can find it. It is interesting. I'll come back to Downton Abbey for a second, which is not an omelet. You can watch Downton Abbey many different ways, and there are people that will get the series and sit down and watch it all in one big gulp. And there are a lot of people that will go to great lengths to be home on Sunday night and watch it at the same time that everyone else is watching it. And I think that that says something. And actually, by the way, a lot of times people will watch it sipping tea and in costume. I think a lot of people want to have a collective experience. They want to share something at the same time. And so, for anyone in the media business, really looking at what seems like two very different trends, the opportunity to do whatever you want whenever you want it, or to really try to have this collective experience that we're all sharing at the same time, is very much a part of what we're seeing in media in terms of consumption. And it's that, to me, is fascinating. The other thing that's fascinating about the, sort of this collective experience, people still want to hold on to that water cooler conversation. Mm-hmm. And they also want to have it in a digital way. And so you have the experience of a lot of people that are watching and that are tweeting. There are a lot of people that create Twitter handles around character names. My favorite is Lady Mary's Eyebrows, and have these long discussions. So it's fun with Downton Abbey. But think about what just happened in this community and the way that if you can convene a conversation around something like Ferguson, and you can encourage people to come together in community and have conversation, but also have conversation via social media, it is very, very powerful.
Well, you brought that up. I was going to raise this issue a little bit later, but let's do it now. Actually, the Nine Network here is going to become heavily involved, as you've indicated, with regard to the postscript Ferguson, if you will. What's going to be happening?
We are at the end of this month working as a national broadcast, convening a town hall, working with Nine Work Network and some of our other producers, including including Gwen Ifill, with a program that we're calling America After Ferguson. And I think you and I had a brief conversation before we went on the air about public media's role in times like this. And I think that public radio, and you have done an amazing job in really convening conversation in these weeks since that tragic event. Where I think public media, I think, does its best work is at moments like this when people really want to come together and have conversation, and we're still here talking about it. And we will be here talking about it because the issues that this raises are not going away. And they're issues that we as community and as a country need to be talking about. And for us to convene a conversation around important issues like this is where I think public broadcasting's founders were really wrestling as they were contemplating the creation of a media organization that was really focused on community and not on commerce. And so we're looking forward to really trying to make, I hope, an important contribution through the broadcast itself. But I think what is going to be far more important are the conversations that we're hoping it will generate among our member stations across this country, radio and television, really talking about where do we go from here and what does it mean?
As we had indicated in that earlier conversation, what has happened so often in the past with other incidents that have initiated a conversation, they tend to peter out. And at some point, as I indicated, if Robin Williams dies, the important conversation gets lost.
Yeah, the news trucks go away.
Right.
Everyone moves on. And an important moment is lost. And so, you know, for those of us in public media, I think we have a true obligation to look at moments like this as a real opportunity for us as community and as a country to come together to have the kind of conversations that will enable us to move forward and to really resolve issues that continue to fester. And so I think that, you know, I am very proud of the work that, you know, has been done thus far. But I think that the bigger conversations need to happen moving ahead. And I'm proud that we're going to be a part of it. I know public radio continues to be a part of these discussions. And hopefully we can make a difference.
We also have the luxury of something that the other media do not, and that is time. We
yes.
can devote more time to issues such as this.
Yes. Well, you know, I often say that, you know, because people sometimes will talk to me and try to compare what we're doing with commercial media. And, you know, I always say, you know, actually, we're in very different businesses. We just happen to use the same tools. We're using the power of media to really focus on what are the needs of communities, which is not the business that commercial media is in. And I think it's unfair sometimes when we're, you know, when we're compared with commercial media is compared with us. We're in very, very different businesses. And I think if we can remain focused on community, then we will be fulfilling our mission as a part of this country.
You're listening to Paula Kerger, who is the president and CEO of PBS. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and we'd like to get you into it. If you'd like to become involved in our discussion, feel free to give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back with Paula Kerger in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Paula Kerger, the president and CEO of PBS. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment, but first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri lawmakers have wrapped up their veto session today. They voted to override Governor Jay Nixon's vetoes of more than $53 million in spending on programs for abused children, schools, and other government services. Legislators voted to override a record 47 line item budget veto. news. And teachers in Illinois' Highland School District went on strike today, shutting down the schools as part of a labor dispute. The walkout came 2 days after Highland teachers rejected the district's latest contract proposal. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Paula Kerger. Well, moving on from Ferguson, and I'm so happy to hear that you're doing what you're doing, and we'll look forward to that when it happens. I'd like to get back to some of the other things that people talk about with regard to PBS. And we'll talk more about Downton Abbey in just a moment, too. But I don't think most people understand the relationship between PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. What is that relationship?
Well, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is really a quasi-governmental organization, which is the way that federal funding flows into public stations. And the corporation was created as a mechanism for that funding, and it oversees the money that goes to public television and public radio stations. PBS itself, and people don't understand. In fact, I remember when I first came to this job, people saying, wow, you know, you're going to be running all these stations around the country. And I said, oh, no, you don't understand. We are in some respects like a co-op. The stations of this country, including Nine Network, are the ones that created public broadcasting. What we do is work on their behalf to create at scale work that they couldn't do on their own. So an individual station wouldn't be able to produce a Sesame Street and a NewsHour and a Masterpiece Theater, Nova Nature, but collecting together, we're able to accomplish these things. In fact, Nine Network is celebrating its 60th anniversary, which is very exciting. It's why I'm here. It's a wonderful station that's doing amazing work in the community, a model, actually, for the country. And it has been in existence 15 years more than we have. And so we are an organization that is constantly looking for ways to help our stations be more effective at the local level.
So the corporation is providing some funding.
There is a
tendency on the part of people to think that, well, the government's paying paying the freight. The donor is just a small portion of it.
Yeah, and it's actually the other way around. So the federal funding that comes into public broadcasting for the on the TV side is 15% of our funding. That's 15% of our funding. And that's an aggregate number. So how much goes to each individual station really depends on a lot of various factors. More money tends to go proportionately to stations that are in rural parts of the country. So if you're in Alaska, for example, the funding for public broadcasting that goes into those stations represents about half of their budget, not 15%. And that's why we actually fight so hard for federal funding, because what we're fighting for is to ensure that every American has access. But the largest percentage of money that comes in, this feels like the roll up to an ask, it comes from viewers like you. It's individual philanthropy. And actually, it's a lot of small contributions, membership contributions from lots of people that makes this magic happen.
Well, every time the government starts talking about money and money problems, the corporation comes up, and there's a conservative element in Congress, as you well know, that wants to reduce that amount of funding. That obviously would be a problem for you.
Well, I don't understand the argument. And I have talked to a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who are passionate supporters of public broadcasting. But, you know, I would argue that that this is one of the most effective public-private partnerships that has ever been built. We have leveraged many times over the federal investment. We're very different from a lot of the other big public broadcasters around the world, like the BBC, which is almost wholly funded by the government. We take that small amount of money and we really make it work. And I would argue that for those that that wonder about the federal investment, the stations that rely the most on the federal appropriation are ones that I think are communities that need public broadcasting, because we're providing access to a range of content and material that's important for those communities. I know it because I've been there. I spend a lot of time on the road. I visit stations all across the country. I just came from Grand Rapids, Michigan earlier this week. I see firsthand the impact that our stations have in communities. And it's communities, particularly in rural communities. I've spent time in one of our smallest stations. It's in Cookeville, Tennessee. It's in the eastern part of the state. there is no other broadcaster there except the public station, and they're creating an archive of that community in the local programs they produce. It's tremendously important stuff.
So far, you've been able to stave off any real assault from those conservative politicians.
Well, I always take nothing for granted, and I would have to say that it is not the brilliance of anyone in Washington that preserves the funding for public broadcasting. It's the fact that people in communities across this country care deeply and let their legislators know that this is important, that has kept the funding for public broadcasting strong.
Well, sometimes when you hear someone refer to the brilliance of people in Washington, some might call that an oxymoron in today's environment, but that's another discussion. While we're here, and we have some calls, and I want to get right to them, but I have to get to this as well. There has been some criticism of PBS as some of the individual stations, because some of the people involved in funding the stations, private donors, like the Koch brothers, who are very, very conservative folks, as most people know, have undue influence, and therefore, because they have so much financial input, can also have input on the kind of programming that is presented by these stations. Your thoughts about that?
I know that there are people that are concerned when they see the involvement of major donors of any kind at stations, that they worry that there may be undue influence. There is an absolute editorial firewall in public television, as there is in public radio, between the people that are contributing and whether that's corporations or individuals or foundations or whatever. And if you look at the funders in public broadcasting, you see a wide swath of political view. That's how it should be. I mean, we are the most American of institutions. What I would also say is that the largest percentage of money that comes into stations is actually small individual contributions. It is not the big major contributions. And I think that whereas there are times when I really would love to have the resources of something like the BBC, I really believe that the fact that we are such a democratic organization with lots of small contributions, that's what keeps us honest and rooted in community. And I think if we violate that trust, then we are done. And so I would challenge anyone to really point to any editorial decisions that we are making that are influenced by anyone. I can tell you that is not the case.
What is often pointed to is that documentary about Park Avenue in New York that WNET did run.
They did run, even though
there was intense pressures, because it involved one of the Koch brothers, David Koch, I believe.
Yeah.
And there was concern that the programmers would pull back because it might offend the big donor.
But it ran.
It ran.
And it ran.
It ran.
Yep.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Let's start with Paul calling from St. Louis. Paul, thanks for being with us. You're on the air with Paula Kruger.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a long-term listener, long-term supporter, as in like 40 years, and love both the NPR and the television programs. But I'm concerned, especially as I think of the radio, that there's been a drift away from substantive programs such as Talk of the Nation and now Michelle Martin's Tell Me More, to much more trendy, shallow programs like The Q, which is replacing Michelle Martin, where there's a focus on pop culture and trendy issues and sophisticated superficial.
Paul, if I may, sorry to interrupt, but you're talking about some of our public radio broadcasts, and Ms. Kruger is here to talk about PBS, the television side of things. Would you like to relate your comments to her, please?
Well, I would say the television is going better. You were talking about the radio, so that's why I decided to call.
Okay, well, go ahead. If you want to finish your comment, go ahead.
Well, that's just it. I'm just concerned about that. What I see is a trend away from substance. I think public television continues actually to have very good substance, and for which I'm grateful. So that's my comment.
Well, I'd like to thank you for your many years of viewership and support, and keep supporting both public television and public radio. We need people like you.
Thank you.
Paul,
thanks.
And thanks. And your views are duly noted here at St. Louis Public Radio, and we thank you for them. Let's bring in Neil calling from Clayton. Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, hi. I want to ask about the fundraising. Our local television station here seems to be fundraising. Every other month, we lose 5 or 6 days of programming while they're hustling for money. There's got to be a better way.
Right. Well, I can't comment specifically about Nine Network, but what I can tell you is that we together, PBS and our stations across the country, are in fact looking very carefully at ways that we can better connect to people who would like to support us. You know, the reality is that the station is able to do what it does in this community because of individual philanthropy, as we've been talking a lot about. It's those individual contributions that really do sustain the station and help it to achieve its mission. But I think there are, as we look forward, lots of opportunities, particularly with work that stations are doing online to try to connect with donors in a way that doesn't interrupt the viewing experience. And so I know that I can speak for my colleagues at Nine Network in saying that anything that can reduce the amount of time that they're spending on the air asking for money, they would be very happy to do. So I hope you are a supporter of your station. I hope you're a supporter of television and radio. And together with that kind of support, you know, we can do really great things. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. I have an email here from Michael Kay. About 25 years ago, he writes, the last time I contributed to PBS, Channel 9 posted a billboard with a very pointed political message. How will PBS or KETC give further coverage of Ferguson with balance and objectivity?
We spend a great deal of time in the work that we do in news and public affairs and ensuring that we have a diversity of perspectives in the work that we do. Before I came into this job, I spent 13 years of my life at our station in New York, and I used to very carefully scrutinize the feedback that came from my community. And a lot of times when I would get, you know, sort of overnight feedback, particularly from news programs, which would generate a lot of calls, I wondered if people were watching the same program, that, you know, they would say that we had been, you know, too, you know, easy on the president, too hard on the president, too conservative, too liberal. And in fact, when I got all those calls on the same show, then I thought maybe we had struck the right chord. I think it's important to understand when you look at trying to create a balanced news program, that does not mean plain vanilla. It means that you have a lot of perspectives, and that sometimes makes people unhappy that we do bring lots of perspectives around the table. I think that's part of what's happened in the rest of news. You see a lot of people that have migrated to different news services because they see only their point of view reflected back. And I think as a country, if we are going to ever get to the critical answers that I know are within our reach, we've got to be able to bring together lots of different perspectives and have the kind of informed conversations that are truly going to make us come together as community. So that is what we are committed to do. Every year there's a national poll that's done that looks at our work, looks at the work that we do in journalism, also looks at us as an institution itself. And for 11 years in a row, we've been ranked the most trusted public institution. And we have been also cited as really being the most balanced in terms of our journalism, and that is what we strive to do. Do we occasionally stumble? Of course we do. Everyone makes mistakes. But I think in the whole, we are absolutely committed to making sure that we are providing a forum for different perspectives.
You know, this has been an issue as long as I've been in broadcasting, which is a long time, is this perception of bias. People hear what they want to hear or hear what they think they hear and draw conclusions that more often than not are erroneous.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, another call. Kay is calling from Trenton, Illinois. Kay, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Don.
Sure.
I am a long-time contributor to both PBS and to my local public radio station.
Way to go, Kay.
Well, they are our primary source of news right now, along with the Post-Dispatch. You know, fracking has come to Illinois, hydraulic fracturing, and I don't see any mention of it in our local media. And I think PBS may have done something on it a while back, but Is there any upcoming program to bring into perspective solar, nuclear, fracking, the whole energy picture that is so important to our climate?
We have done coverage on fracking, and I am, although I can't tell you specifically sitting here what programs we have coming up in the current year, I am certain that we have within both our news and public affairs, as well as within some of the documentaries, continued coverage, because it's an ongoing issue, a significant ongoing issue for communities across the country.
Well, thank you. I hope you'll continue.
You're welcome.
Yeah, the environment is a very important issue mm-hmm. for PBS. I have noted.
Yeah. We, you know, we have ongoing reporting coming out of, you know, various, you know, parts of our organization. On Wednesday nights, we focus a lot on science and natural history, and we have done some reporting there. Obviously, Frontline, which is our long-running much awarded investigative journalism series, has covered this issue as well, and so it is an area that we feel is tremendously important. I know that Nine Network here is also very focused on various issues around environmental, particularly around water, as a matter of fact, not necessarily fracking. But you know, I think that these are all issues that are, you know, that are important and that are meritorious of ongoing reporting and coverage.
You know, education is obviously an important part of what you do as well. What sort of emphasis is PBS putting on issue STEM issues, if you will, science, technology, engineering, and math? I mean, we're so far behind in this area, and it's such a concern to so many educators.
It's a great question. We have a very large audience under five, and so when we look at education, we actually look at it from several different perspectives. And with STEM in particular, we focus on science, technology, engineering, and math subjects, beginning at the earliest ages. And so, even within our pre-K curriculum, and I use that word purposely because I think a lot of people think of public broadcasting and they think of our children's programming and they think of it as a safe, nice place for children to spend time, particularly when parents are, you know, doing the laundry or washing dishes or making dinner or whatever. But the reality is the programs that we produce are not just safe and fun, but they also have a curriculum basis, and they have been purposely built looking at all of the skills, the basic skills that kids need to enter school prepared to learn. Most, you know, a lot of homes in this country, unfortunately, don't have computers and may not have books, but there are television sets, and we know that we can reach children that are of most need in giving them an opportunity to try to enter school with some of these basic skills, and STEM is very much a part of that. We also have, you know, through our ongoing program series, a deep commitment to science, and in particular, and that is why we've created a block of programs on Wednesday night that I like to think of as the smartest night on TV, which is designed for both adults, who I think could also use science education, as well as kids. And then we have a service that we have built directly in the schools that delivers content to teachers. These are, you know, short video clips and digitized objects and animations and so forth. And the emphasis in that is actually on STEM. It's all organized around grade level and by subject matter, and actually correlated against standards. And so it's easy for teachers to use, and it really brings the education experience to life. And we have found that particularly for STEM subjects, actually, science as well as math, as a matter of fact, that that media is a great way to help kids really understand complicated concepts and actually get excited about science.
You know, it's an awesome responsibility that you have, because my notes here, it's indicated 80% of the kids in this country watch your programming.
Yes. And I would say that we're talking about STEM, but we really think about STEM in terms of STEAM, which in adding arts into it. So, for example, one of our recent new additions to our kids lineup is a series called Peg Plus Cat, which is designed to help young children, particularly girls, become interested and excited about math. And part of what is used as a tool to help kids remember some of the concepts that are in the series is music. And so, and if you watch the program, there is a very interesting style to the animation that incorporates art. So I think that all of these subjects, you know, woven together are important for kids.
Yeah. It's a responsibility and an opportunity, isn't
it? It's absolutely an opportunity.
Let's take another break. Paula Kirger is our guest. She's the president and CEO of PBS. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. And we have some lines open. If you'd like to get back into it, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. We continue our conversation with Paula Kirger of PBS. I have a couple of emails and tweets here, Paula, that I'll read to you and you can respond. Does PBS have any plans to expand their local news coverage?
Well, that's a question for Nine Network, but I do believe that they are mostly focused on some of the ongoing discussions, and that's where they're putting their energy.
Yeah. Thank you, and this is from Rachel. Thank you for finally offering Midsummer Murders. The British series has a huge fan base. We love Midsummer. Keep the episodes coming.
Great.
Yeah. Contact and contract, or however we want to characterize it, with the BBC and British Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. How does that all come about?
Well, we've worked with actually various producers in the UK over the years in bringing programming to the American public that we think is of special interest. And, of course, Downton Abbey, which actually is not a project of the BBC, but certainly came to us through a relationship with a producing company in the UK, is a big part of our schedule. Sherlock, which for those of you who love trivia, won more Emmy Awards this year than any other program on television. We're very proud of it, and proud of Benedict Cumberbatch in particular for his Emmy. And we have a lot of great drama, and we have a number of mysteries coming up in the fall. So there's a lot, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of great drama on television right now, and I'd like to think that we played a part in helping that sort of all come together. I think the fact that we've been so successful with our drama is something that other broadcasters have paid attention to.
How do you explain the American interest in things British, the Anglophiles among us? British mysteries and British drama are very, very popular here, obviously.
It's hugely popular, and I'm not sure that I can fully explain our fascination with Britain. I think that there's they're obviously a part of our history, and I think that there's so many similarities but so many differences between our two societies that people are fascinated. I will say that a lot of people ask me why a series like Downton Abbey is so successful. Yeah. And of course you have these moments, and they truly are like lightning in a bottle. I mean, sometimes the stars align and a program just becomes wildly popular. I think the popularity of that series is based on a number of things. One, it is beautifully produced with a lot of care and attention. There is historian on set that really pays attention to every aspect. It's beautifully shot. Care in terms of costume and so forth. The care that was taken in the casting is apparent. The characters and the way that they're drawn. By the way, Julian Fellowes, who created Downton Abbey, who created Gosford Park, writes every line of dialogue for every character. And I think that his brilliance shines through that series. People care about the characters. I think that part of history is of interest to people. And I believe that part of the interest in Downton Abbey is also the way that women are and those female characters are developed. And I think that there are aspects of society that don't feel that are that far away in terms of history, but it feels so distant in the way that women didn't have the right to inherit property and so forth. And then, of course, there's Maggie Smith. So I think all of that woven together has really created a series that we're really very proud of.
Did you make the decision to go with Downton Abbey?
There were a lot of people that will say that we can claim credit for Downton Abbey, and I will not be one. I was part of the process, but I would not give myself a lot of credit other than to say. Now, here's an interesting fact, though: the season that of Masterpiece that Downton Abbey was a part also included two other programs. One was we had been approached by Jean Marsh, who wanted to bring back Upstairs Downstairs, which had been the most popular drama series on public broadcasting, and one that people continually asked to if we would consider bringing back. And then we were approached about this wonderful new production of Sherlock, which has turned out to be also quite a phenomenon in and of itself. And then there was this this idea of approaching Julian Fellowes, who had done Gosford Park, about doing such a thing. And we did have a bit of a discussion about Upstairs, Downstairs, and Downton Abbey, both in the same season. And there was a moment we could have made a different decision, and thank goodness we didn't, because it was the right decision to do both.
I wonder how many people in making that decision had any kind of a clue that it was going to become the most popular.
No one, even the producer, did not have a sense. And then when it really and you knew that it was something special. I mean, you look at a program like that, and you know that a traditional PBS viewer on Sunday nights that loves Masterpiece is going to love a series like that. But then when you look at the number of people that have not been regular viewers of PBS that have come in, that's, to me, what's been exciting. And, of course, you know when you're the subject of a Saturday Night Live skit that you've clearly crossed over into another place altogether.
You have made it.
Yes.
Let's go back to the phones. Nancy joins us from University City. Nancy, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Paula, I think you're kidding yourself that Channel 9 here is doing a good job. It's mostly a children's program and fundraising. The fundraising is much more than Neil described. I'm not going to go into it. But I will tell you that I offered to buy, which I heard there is such a thing, the Masterpiece Channel for the St. Louis area. And I never heard another word from Channel 9. I did have a one-string attached, which was that no money was to go to the three guys that are always on Channel 9 that don't do anything.
But
I will tell you, yes, Don.
Oh, finish. I'm sorry. I thought you were finished.
I am.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. Paula, do you want to respond?
I only see some of the work that is shared from Channel 9 that looks quite wonderful to me. So I don't live here. I can't comment on the fundraising at all. But I do know some of the work that the station has had underway in the community. I know some of the big projects that they've done. They've been part of a big project recently to try to encourage young people to graduate, and it's a bigger project, a national project called American Graduate. It's been quite significant. I know of some of the work that they've done in the arts, and I've seen it. The fundraising drives, I know, are a frustration, and I think you just need to know that we are all committed to trying to figure out other ways that we can bring the resources in to help the station be strong. Believe me, if they didn't have to do it, they wouldn't.
People take their television very personally. When you invite something or someone into your living room night after night, you feel you have certain options in your criticism.
Yep.
Nancy, thank you for your call. Let's bring in Elizabeth. Elizabeth, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. I would like to ask why the Bill Moyers show was cut in half. Used to be an hour. Now it's half an hour. They keep changing the times when it's on. And I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that he's very critical of the Koch brothers, of big banks, of oil companies, of Citizens United ruling. Does that have anything to do with the fact that his show was cut in half?
No. Bill cut his own show in half. Bill had made the decision for a lot of reasons and a lot of personal reasons that a half-hour show is something that he was physically up to doing and wanted to do a weekly regular show, and that's how that show became a half an hour. It was Bill's decision.
Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Let's change the tone somewhat and bring in Paul calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. Yeah, I have a little different twist on all this. What I think the best thing about PBS is it gets rid of people having that couch potato habit because you don't advertise food. So you can actually lose weight by watching PBS. And the cat loves Nova. No matter where the cat is in the house, she hears that, you know, nature comes on. The cat is right there.
You should take a picture of your cat watching nature and send it to me. I would love to see it. That would be fun.
Okay, I'll do that.
And, Paul, if losing weight works for you, I have to tell you it doesn't work for everybody. Current company being a big part of that. Thank you for your call.
Sure.
Let's ask Sheila to come into the conversation. She's calling from Edwardsville. Go ahead, Sheila.
Hi. I'm visiting here from Colorado. And in Colorado, on Colorado Public Television, we get Doctor Who. And I can't find Doctor Who here. I can find it on the BBC, but there's no new doctor. Are you guys going to do that on PBS in general?
Well, I'll tell you, I talked about this a little earlier when I was describing how public broadcasting is structured. And that is PBS in this country. So if you're traveling around and you go from station to station, you'll see a lot of programming that looks the same, but it's different. And each station in every community makes the decision as to which programs they put on the air. And so some carry different series and some don't. So if you have a series that you're interested in seeing in public broadcasting, my friend Jack Elmish is going to hate me for saying that, but you should let them know. I mean, we're a community station, we're a public station, and the people that run the stations really do care about what people in the community want to see. So, a series like Doctor Who actually doesn't come through PBS. Stations acquire that directly. And if series like that are things that you're interested in, then you should certainly let Nine Network know.
Yeah. There's
a new doctor.
There is a new doctor. I know.
Yeah, Sheila, thanks so much for the call. I don't know if the Doctor Who series, past, present, or future, are involved with Netflix at all. But, I mean, that's really a pretty good way to get at some of your programming, some of your older programming.
Yeah, and we have a relationship with Netflix where we the director of Doctor Who is the director of Sherlock. So we, all of this all comes together in different ways. But yeah, a number of our series and a number of series that are produced by others like the BBC are available in places like Netflix. So it is a source of opportunity to see programs.
Yeah. Only a couple of minutes left. Let's talk for a moment or two about why you're here. You mentioned earlier on that it's the 60th anniversary of the Nine Network. That's a pretty big deal. 60 years is a long time.
It's a very long time in television years too, yeah. And so it is one of the earlier stations that came on the air. And so 60th anniversary is, in fact, a very big deal in public media. And they'll be launching this new public media commons, which I've just seen a little bit of as I've come in this morning. And it looks like a wonderful space. It's great to see public radio, public television together in one location serving the community. And it's great to see a space where clearly people of the community will convene.
That's going to be a very vibrant space. We had a sneak preview the other night, and it really is quite something. The digital age has certainly arrived in the space between the two stations. And this is really an opportunity to bring people kind of into the tent in a little more personal way than has been the case in the past.
I think literally bring them into the tent because I think that, and we've talked about this again, I think that it's interesting to me that we have an opportunity through all of social media to have conversations, and we can pull people together. We can actually pull people together around areas of common interest, not necessarily geography. But I think that, people really do hunger to physically be together. It's why people still go to movie theaters. It's why people participate in various things. And I think that, when you think of the power of public media, public TV and public radio together, and the opportunity to have, a place where people can also convene, it's going to be exciting. This is very unique. I haven't seen a setup quite like this anywhere.
I was going to ask if you'd run across something like that.
I've seen public television and public radio that have that have created space, but nothing like this. And this looks pretty exciting to me. Great for St. Louis.
Also exciting is what we've done, joining forces with the online newspaper, The Beacon, and bringing our staffs together.
Yeah.
That's I think, presages the future of in many ways. Paula Kirger, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Enjoy your stay in St. Louis.
Wonderful to be here.
Public television seems to be alive and well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with St. Louis Symphony Music Director David Robertson. He'll also take a look at Shakespeare in the Streets production of In Downtown Clayton, that is. And in the next installment of Sound Bites, produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll talk about wine in St. Louis. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, our legal roundtable panel will examine current issues pertaining to the law. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Erica Smith, Aaron Doerr, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.